Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop update from the 2024 American Society of Medical Society of Hematology, or ASH, annual meeting. And today's program is supported by AbbVie, Gilead, and a grant from Genentech. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our speakers, I want to just let you know that we have over 305 participants on today's program, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, and suburban communities. And we also have quite a number of international participants, and I'm going to name the countries, from Algeria, Canada, Ghana, India, Japan, Pakistan, Philippines, Trinidad, Tobago, South Africa, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. So it is truly a global call. And it's a credit to all of you that you chose to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. And Dr. Morrow is Director, Chronic Myeloid Leukemia Program Managed Member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Morrow will be addressing the overview of blood cancers with new research presented at ASH and disease-specific treatment updates presented at ASH on leukemia. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morrow.
Well, thanks, Carolyn, and thanks, everybody, for joining. I want to wish everyone a happy holiday season and a hopefully a healthy new year in advance. And, you know, my first task is to mention an overview of blood cancer treatments. And I think the thing I'd like to highlight is that I think we're getting a lot smarter and a lot better. And I'm hoping to share some of my talk. We'll be focusing on some of the better and smarter ways we've been able to treat blood cancer, meaning that historically blood cancers were obviously and can be, some can be chronic and some can be acute. I'll get to that in a moment. And they often are quite, you know, quite dangerous, and they can cause symptoms, and they can be, you know, quite frightening. And you know, some of the major concerns we have, of course, is dysfunction of the blood, the strength of chemotherapy that we historically would use in blood cancers, particularly with patients having a lot of side effects, and of course the threat of the diseases, you know, sort of being in folks being in a tight spot. I think we've come a long way, and that we've developed a lot of medications that are smarter therapies that work by mechanisms that don't harm the patient and just harm the cancer and clear the cancer, that are able to treat people who haven't had luck with maybe what we think is the best treatment we have now. We have great options for people who perhaps miss on the first attempt, or their leukemia returns, or maybe the therapy we'd like to give, which may be better still, but still may have a fairly high risk, isn't easy to deliver or might be too risky. You know, we always, of course, we do want to have a do-no-harm approach. We have to harm the leukemia, but we don't want to harm the patient. So leukemias, of course, are a broad array, or blood cancers are a broad array of diseases. We're going to cover leukemias, lymphomas, myelomas, myeloproliferative diseases today. So stand by. We're going to get an update on a lot of different areas. Now, the blood cancers essentially are disorders that are related to the cell of origin, not necessarily where they are. You know, a colon cancer comes from the colon, but can spread and cause trouble in other parts of the body. But leukemia is generally a disease of the, or blood cancers are generally a disease of the bone marrow, the lymph nodes, and some of the organs that filter the blood, like the liver and the spleen. Sometimes other parts of the body can be affected as well. There are chronic leukemias, such as CLL and CML. There are low-grade lymphomas, which are diseases that can be, you know, a little bit more slow in their onset and timing to cause trouble and needs for treatment. They can be aggressive lymphomas. there are diseases which can present in more difficult states or even precursor states like myeloma, and then proliferative diseases, which are chronic illnesses and can be, some can be managed with simple interventions. Some require, of course, more surveillance and caution and more intensive therapies. Many people need support for their blood if they're getting treatment to replace healthy blood via transfusions. Many people need antibiotics and supportive care, as we call it, medicines to essentially bolster their immune system and them as well to get them through treatment. But again, we've gotten a lot smarter. So again, we're going to cover a lot of ground. And my task today was to talk about leukemia. So I'm going to talk about three different areas. We were just all, or hopefully at least got data from a meeting called the American Society for Hematology meeting, which is the basis of the call, which, if you didn't know, is a meeting where 30,000 plus people gather in one of the cities in the U.S. And we gather, we collaborate, we share our data, we have a myriad of presentations and education sessions and talks to help us all get up to speed. It's a wonderful meeting. It's a great way to meet colleagues. Many of us say it's not just about seeing the research being presented as if you're in class and you're watching the presentations and taking in the data. It's about seeing your colleagues, talking to them about the work you're doing together or the work you'd like to do together, and connecting with friends and colleagues. At the ASH meeting, one of the bigger sessions is called the plenary session, where we have the data that we think is of perhaps most importance. And one of the abstracts there is related to acute leukemia, so I really would be remiss if I didn't talk about that. So this is good news for children. So we saw at the ASH meeting a study for children who were being treated for what's called B-cell ALL, and that would be one of the most common types of leukemia seen in children. Now, this was a study looking where kids were getting the best chemotherapy options we had available to get into remission and even beyond remission, you know, sort of deepening the remission. And this is a very treatable form of cancer, thank goodness, in children. It's very difficult. It's very heartbreaking to watch kids go through it, but that success rates are very high. And so can we do even better? So what was introduced to children who were in remission of various types, various qualities, they sort of categorized kids as being a little bit higher or a bit lower risk of needing more treatment or relapse, based on some of the key tests that we do during the treatment. And they then said, if we add an antibody conjugate drug called blinatumomab, which engages the leukemia cells and connects them with our own immune system or T cells to help clear them. And this is a medicine that's been approved and has been useful for our adult patients and children and in many other settings. But this is a very large and key study to show what's called a randomized trial to say, is it helpful to add some of this medication, blinatumomab, to certain patients, and wow, was it a positive study. Over thousands of patients, or thousands of children participated in this trial, and the good news was that this drug, blinatumomab, boosted the rates of remission, which are, for the record, were in the 80s already, 80s to 90s, up even higher, and was very safe and very easy to deliver, and we didn't need to use much. So that was a fantastic, and what we call practice-changing or paradigm-shifting study. And that comes from a very large randomized study, and that's why it made it to the plenary session. So let me turn now to AML. So acute myeloid leukemia is a disease of kids and adults too, but more adults, especially as we age. And so as I was saying earlier, sometimes folks aren't easy to tolerate or withstand chemotherapy. And that's one sort of area we paid a lot of attention to. And the second was that acute myeloid leukemia, AML, we used to think of it as how could we characterize it by looking down the microscope or looking at the cells that cause the leukemia. But we've really gotten a lot smarter by understanding the genetics and the things that turn the leukemia on and cause the damage. So this year's ASH, the word on AML was, a lot of it had to do with something called menin. So what is menin? Menin is a part of the metabolic pathway, or the signaling pathway, that leukemia cells depend on. And a number of the mutations or changes that cause leukemia to happen, AML, are related to this menin pathway. So a menin inhibitor manages the mutations that happen in acute myeloid leukemia in about a good third to almost half of patients. As we talk medical speak about pathways, it's sort of upstream from a lot of the things that are damaged in leukemia. So it sort of sits higher up and allows us, if we can inhibit this pathway, to probably really have a significant impact on shutting down leukemia. So menin inhibitors have been developed. And there was a study in adults using menin inhibitors. There were actually two that I wanted to mention. One was a trial using a drug called ziftomenib, and that was combined with chemotherapy that we normally use. So using our best chemotherapy and adding this drug. And our chemotherapy is good, but it's not perfect. So we were trying to see if patients who had the right mutation, who had higher risk leukemia, who probably did not have as high an odds of going in remission, would benefit from the addition of this medication. And so an early study like this is really looking at safety and side effects. And I think the answer was that really didn't seem to add any more side effects than what we might see with the chemotherapy we use already, which has side effects, but we're able to manage them quite well. And the great news here was that this drug really boosted the response rates up into the 90 to 100% range, depending on the group of patients. So by targeting this pathway using a drug, a menin inhibitor, we are really able to boost response rates for patients with AML. A number of patients were able to go on to the next thing they probably needed, which might have been a bone marrow transplant. And this trial is now leading to the next steps to see how we should best incorporate this menin inhibitor into treatment of AML, particularly when we have this known switch that's abnormal or mutations. The names of the mutations are called NPM1 or KMT2A mutations. There was a second study in AML, which characterizes something I think I mentioned earlier, which was, can we treat patients using an easier regimen? And I'll be a bit more brief on this, but this was another menin inhibitor called revumenib, which has already been approved because it's been studied in both adults and children, and already proven in the FDA that it's actually quite helpful in bringing patients into remission. So smart leukemia doctors came up with the idea to say, let's use our best oral regimen. Use an oral medication called venetoclax, which is a BCL-2 inhibitor, which has really revolutionized the treatment of AML. Let's use an oral form of a newer type of chemotherapy drug called oral decitabine, combined with a drug cedazuridine, and then this menin inhibitor. It was called the SAVE combination, very nice name. And I'll tell you that this was a very well-tolerated chemotherapy regimen in people who weren't able to probably manage as easily the side effects of conventional chemotherapy, and the response rates were noticeably higher than what we might have seen using our previous regimens. So using essentially a bit of an easier regimen, we have better response rates. You really can't beat that. And now I'll finish with one last disease area, which is, of course, my favorite and what I study and work in the most, which is chronic myeloid leukemia. We have a lot of more long-term questions in this space, but at ASH this year, we had an update from a trial called the ASK for First trial. So this in CML, we use oral targeted drugs called BCR-ABL inhibitors. And asciminib was approved a few years ago now for use for people who had already had medication but where it wasn't working, or maybe they had side effects. But about a month ago, this drug was approved for use for patients at diagnosis. And at ASH, we saw an update for showing that after 2 years of study, asciminib, or Scemblix, is continuing to be better than our previous and oldest drug, Gleevec, now is showing to be probably more significantly better than our very good second-generation drugs called dasatinib, nilotinib, and bosutinib, and is still safer. So we're really pushing the envelope higher in chronic myeloid leukemia, and now we have a bit more confidence that asciminib should be an important part of our treatment regimen, particularly for newly diagnosed CML patients, we can think about it, and definitely for people who have already had treatment. There were a lot of other abstracts to cover, but I think I need to stop here in the interest of time and hand it back to my colleagues for updates in other disease areas.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Morrow. That was just a wonderful presentation. You are the first speaker, so you've really set the stage for today's program as well, in really giving an overview of the purpose of ASH and in terms of focusing on leukemia updates from leukemia. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Nilanjan Ghosh, and Dr. Ghosh is Carrie and Simone Victor Family Foundation Endowed Chair, Chair, Department of Hematology, Oncology, Blood Cancer, and Blood Disorders, Chief Lymphoma Division, Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute, Charlotte, North Carolina, Professor of Internal Medicine, Wake Forest University School of Medicine, Member Atrium Health, Wake Forest Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Ghosh will be discussing specific treatment updates presented at ASH on lymphoma and the role of precision medicine and clinical trials. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ghosh.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to come back this year and present you some ASH updates in lymphoma. So I'll start perhaps with mantle cell lymphoma. I think amongst the lymphomas, this was the year for mantle cell lymphoma at ASH. Even though mantle cell lymphoma is a rare lymphoma, it's where we've seen a lot of energy and development in terms of targeted therapies as well as overall paradigm shifts in treatment. So for a long time, for a younger, fitter patient with mantle cell lymphoma, the standard was induction with chemoimmunotherapy, and there were many different options and variations of those, followed by a consolidation with autologous stem cell transplant. And there was a large study from the intergroup, but led by ECOG, which we participated in as well. And this was the ECOG EA4151 study, which was presented at the late-breaking abstract session. And, this was a study which basically randomized patients after they finished their initial induction therapy with chemoimmunotherapy to two different arms based on their MRD status. So what is MRD? It's minimal residual disease, this is tested by a clonoSEQ, which looks at very minimal levels of in the blood, very minimal levels of tumor in the bloodstream. So for patients who achieved a traditional complete remission by scans and bone marrow biopsy after completing their frontline chemotherapy could be tested on the study by clonoSEQ, and if they were considered to be negative by minimal residual disease status, then they were randomized to get either an autologous transplant or no autologous transplant, but both groups got rituximab maintenance, which is considered a standard in mantle cell lymphoma for 3 years. And for those people who were MRD positive or did not achieve a complete response, but got partial response, they could just get the autologous transplant with rituximab. So again, the whole idea was to question whether a transplant is truly needed if you are getting the deepest of the deepest remissions, which we can detect not only by scans, but also by this molecular test from the blood. And what Dr. Fenske presented was really exciting data showing that for those patients who had achieved MRD negativity, at least at 3 years, there was no benefit to getting the transplant. And we don't know where things will be down the road, but at least at 3 years, there was not really much benefit to the transplant at all. However, there might be benefit for patients from autologous transplant if they were MRD positive after induction. Those who converted to undetectable MRD post-autologous transplant did demonstrate improved overall survival and were free of progression during the time of the follow-up. So I think this is an important paradigm shift where now, at least in the U.S., we can get MRD testing available now and it'll be covered for patients with mantle cell lymphoma at end of treatment. And it is, one of the fields, the field is moving more towards targeted therapy anyway. So having that option to omit transplant for these patients who get very deep remissions is certainly an option and should be discussed. Along those lines, there was another large study which was presented, and this was a German study called the Triangle Study, which was presented. It has been presented before, but going along the lines of precision therapy, we know that BTK inhibitors have very strong activity in mantle cell lymphoma. And what this Triangle Study did was it took standard induction followed by autologous transplant, which is as a standard arm, and then it added BTK inhibitors to two other arms where they got the same chemotherapy, but they also had a BTK inhibitor added called ibrutinib in one arm with the transplant, and a third arm where BTK inhibitor was added, but there was no transplant. So you can see the theme here. The field is trying to see whether this difficult treatment, autologous transplant, can there be a group of patients who would not benefit from getting this autologous transplant because there are side effects associated with the transplant. So in this important large study from Germany, they also noted that in terms of progression-free survival, as well as now they have some overall survival benefit of, if you add the BTK inhibitor, then first of all, that is beneficial. And so adding BTK inhibitor to the induction regimen was beneficial. And then secondly, if you do that, then there was no benefit to adding an autologous transplant. So now you have two large studies which are questioning the role of autologous transplant in this disease. And the field is moving towards, incorporation of BTK inhibitors in frontline therapy for mantle cell lymphoma. A third study also in mantle cell lymphoma, it's amazing that like three large studies got reported. It's rare in a rare disease to have everything fall come through, around the same time. It's not common. So there was another study from the ECOG group, which showed that, when you add acalabrutinib, a more commonly used BTK inhibitor in mantle cell lymphoma these days, to bendamustine rituximab, showed a really good safety profile and also really excellent efficacy. However, when it was added to bendamustine rituximab and high-dose cytarabine, which is also, another chemotherapy which is used in the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma, it mainly added to toxicity and really didn't really improve outcomes. So I think the upshot of that study was, what do you do before the transplant? You could go with just, bendamustine rituximab in addition to acalabrutinib. Or if you were to just go without a acalabrutinib, then you would the standard arm on that one arm on that study was bendamustine rituximab and rituximab cytarabine. What happens with the cytarabine is there's a lot of side effects in terms of low platelets and significantly compromised immune system. So I think bendamustine rituximab, acalabrutinib, is a relatively good option which gives excellent results, but also is less toxic. So a lot is happening in the space of mantle cell lymphoma. To sum it up, incorporation of targeted agents in frontline therapy and identification of patients who would not benefit from autologous transplant is where the field is moving. And, so that's mantle cell, and I know we are short of time, so I'll probably just give snippets for, other lymphomas. Large B-cell lymphoma, we saw the update 5-year results from the POLAR-X study, which is an important study combining POLAR-CHP, where polatuzumab replaces vincristine from R-CHOP, and compare that to the standard treatment, which has been there for couple of decades or more with R-CHOP chemotherapy. And this has been previously presented, but now we got the 5-year update. And what it showed is that the difference in progression-free survival at 5 years was still maintained, meaning that at 5 years, about 65% of patients who got POLR CHP remained in a remission, versus in R-CHOP, it was 59%. Yes, the difference is small, but I think it's important because this is a potentially curative disease, and if you can cure more patients with frontline therapy, then they would not need second-line therapies, even though we have excellent second-line therapies like CAR T-cell therapy, which have made a big improvement in outcomes for diffuse large cell lymphoma. And about 30 to 40% of patients can be cured in the second line, but if they have access to CAR T-cell therapy. However, there are huge issues with access to this treatment. So trying to cure, the most number of patients possibly in the frontline setting is very important. So this was an important study for that. There was no improvement in overall survival, and it might be because we do have good second-line and third-line therapies, such as CAR T-cell therapies and bispecific antibodies in the second- and third-line setting, along with other treatments, which like tafasitamab and other things, which are also and loncastuximab, which are available in the second-line and beyond. So I think that was another important study. We also saw a lot of studies in CAR T-cell therapy in the real-world setting from CIBMTR data sets showing very similar outcomes to what was done in the clinical trials. So that it's great to see that real-world studies in CAR T-cell therapy are matching up to the clinical trials, which led to their approval. A good subset of patients getting complete remission as well as longer-term remissions. What was interesting at ASH was the bispecific antibody outcomes. I think bispecific antibodies have made a significant improvement in those patients, especially if they have progressed after CAR T-cell therapy. So glofitamab, epcoritamab are important bispecific antibodies in diffuse large cell lymphoma. There was a study which was presented combining a bispecific antibody called mosunetuzumab with polatuzumab and showing that it has really great activity when you compare it with another standard treatment. I think there is ever increasing number of these bispecific antibody treatments now available, at least through clinical trials, in the second line setting, and that would be important for patients who don't have access to CAR T-cell therapy. They are not yet approved, but I think the field is moving towards, making bispecific antibodies go, higher up in the line of therapy, moving up to many trials now looking at even frontline therapies. In follicular lymphoma, there was an important presentation in the late-breaking abstract session looking at addition of the CD19 monoclonal antibody tafasitamab to rituximab plus lenalidomide compared to rituximab lenalidomide alone, showing a significant improvement in progression-free survival in that setting. So I think that's not yet approved, but everywhere you see in lymphoma, the field is really moving to more targeted therapies moving up. We saw that in mantle cell. We are seeing also in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, different types of targeted therapies coming up and in follicular lymphoma. Another paradigm shift which is happening in follicular lymphoma is trials which are looking at bispecific antibodies in the frontline setting. We saw really good data with single agent bispecific antibody mosunetuzumab in frontline follicular lymphoma, showing very high response rates, low toxicity, and the field is moving such that, these trials are, there will be trials comparing bispecific antibodies to standard chemoimmunotherapy, and if they are positive, chemo is taking the back seat, and targeted therapy is starting to take the front seat in many of these diseases. So that's an exciting development, lesser side effects, and more precision killing of tumor cells. So I know we are short of time. I could speak 1 hour about lymphoma, but I'd like to pass it on to my colleagues for other discussions, and happy to take questions at the end.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ghosh. That was really a very comprehensive, wonderful presentation on lymphoma, a lot of information. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Butler, and Dr. Butler is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine, Mays MD Anderson Cancer Center, UT Health San Antonio. And Dr. Butler will be addressing disease-specific treatment updates presented at ASH on multiple myeloma and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Butler.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoy doing these events. It's always fun to talk about the latest things that come out at an annual meeting like this. Multiple myeloma is an area where the treatment landscape has become a little bewildering, even for people like me who think about it all the time. We've had so many new drugs come along, so many breakthroughs that as a patient, it can be really hard to keep track of which drugs are which. It's not helped by the fact that drugs have two names. Then we use a lot of acronyms and abbreviations for combinations of drugs that we're comfortable using. So I'll try to give just the highlights of things that are new that have come out in this most recent meeting. And I divide those up into three categories. So there's always some new drugs on the horizon, new drugs that aren't yet available on the market but are promising and may be available soon, and we'll talk about. I'll mention a few of those just to sort of put the names on the radar. New drugs. It's you might think that the newest drug is always going to be the best or the most important drug, and it's that's rarely the case. Often the newest drugs are used as they become useful as last resorts when all the other options that we already have aren't working. And in most cases, you're still better off staying with tried and true things. But then the second, area of research is taking newer or relatively new treatments and finding ways to use them earlier in the course of the disease. And so something that starts out as a very late option can become something that we use at the beginning or near the beginning. And there are a couple of studies that helped us do that, and I'll mention those. And then finally, and I think this is something that gets probably neglected and we should think more about, doing research that allows us to stop doing certain things. Are certain treatments or other things that we do for people maybe not necessary, and we can do a less is more approach? And there's a couple of cases where that seems to be true based on the emerging research. The new drugs that are on the horizon that you may hear about in the future, there's a couple of new oral drugs in development. One is called iberdomide. One is called mezigdomide. These are a new family of drugs called CELMoDs, but they're not all that different in terms of how they work and the side effects and everything from drugs that are quite familiar to anyone with myeloma, like Revlimid or lenalidomide, and pomalidomide or Pomalyst. These are thought of as next generation versions. Both of these drugs are showing promise. Iberdomide is actually being tried as an early treatment as they're combining it with frontline therapy, but most of the studies for both of these are as a second or a third option in combination with other drugs. Then we have a family of medicines called bispecific antibodies. This has been a really exciting trend in myeloma over the last few years. We have three that we're already using that are outside of studies that are on the market. And there are a couple new ones that are still being developed, and I'll just mention those, cevostamab and ententamig. I think it's too early to say whether either of those is going to be a major breakthrough or just add additional options to in an area where we already have some good options. The final thing that's new is really weirdly a deja vu, because there's a drug called belantamab mafodotin, or Blenrep, that was approved and in use up until about 2 years ago. And some of the research at that time that was emerging about this drug when we were using it on its own didn't meet our expectations. There was some disappointments in one of the studies. It was never thought of as a bad drug. It just wasn't as good as promised, and it didn't meet what had been set. It didn't clear the bar that had been set for it by the FDA, and it was removed from the market. Now there are studies using that drug in combinations. And in myeloma, we almost always have to combine drugs. That we can't get very far with using a drug all by itself. And so there are a number of combinations of Blenrep with other things that seem to be much better. And I think it may be a drug that we can start using again soon for relapse myeloma, potentially even at the beginning, although that's a space where we already have some really good options. In terms of using drugs earlier, one of those drugs that seems to be moving in that direction is teclistamab, or Tecvayli. This is one of the bispecific antibodies I mentioned, and we've been using it on its own. We've been seeing good results. Now we're seeing, it looks like, ways that we may be able to use it in combinations with other drugs and potentially even use it at the beginning. That's not ready for prime time, but that's the early studies are showing promise there. I know time is scarce, so I'll skip over a few of the abstracts I was going to mention. There's one important study, though, and there may be people in this group where this is a question: is what should we do for maintenance therapy? If your myeloma is in remission, maybe you've had a stem cell transplant, we've always given a drug called Revlimid or lenalidomide for those patients, but we're seeing more and more data, and there was an important study presented called the ARIGA trial that showed that if we add daratumumab or Darzalex, that we can keep more people in remission for longer. And in better remissions, and there's that based on the minimal residual disease. So that's already something that some of us have started to do in selected patients, but I think it's becoming more and more mainstream to use Darzalex as a maintenance drug. It means staying on injections long-term as opposed to just pills, so there's a convenience factor, but it seems to be worth it in terms of the outcomes. And then finally, I said I would talk about research into stopping things. So there's we've long wondered if maintenance therapy for myeloma is something we can stop when somebody's in remission for a long period of time. And the answer seems to be yes. And there was a study that established that only under certain conditions. We need to do bone marrow biopsies and show that the disease is under excellent control, meaning no minimal residual disease, and that we've maintained that control for 3 years. That was what they used as a stopping point. People who met that could stop all maintenance therapy, which is nice if you don't need it to be not on any medication. They still need to be monitored, and relapses are still possible, but they didn't seem to be common in that study, and they were still manageable if they did happen. And so the benefit of continuing maintenance once you're MRD negative for that long seems to be negligible. And then the final thing that I like is there's a study done about the 24-hour urine collections. This is kind of a hassle that some people with myeloma go through. And we're starting to do fewer and fewer of those. And there was a study done that basically showed that when you have reliable blood tests outside of a few specific situations, they tell you all that you need to know, and you can dispense with the urine, carrying your urine into a clinic appointment, which is something nobody really loves to do. Okay, I know that I'm also supposed to talk about preparing for telehealth visits, but I really don't want to eat into Dr. Mess's time. Telehealth is something that was a new reality for all of us a few years ago in the pandemic, but by now it's sort of familiar, and hopefully most people have already done it. I think it's like any visit, it's good to prepare in advance with some idea of what questions you have, because when you're in the situation, your mind often goes blank and you forget what you were going to ask. The other challenge that's been created for a lot of people is now that everybody has access to their own lab results, they look through them and then have to try to interpret them and have to decide whether or not to worry. And my advice is generally don't do that, because there are a lot of things that get reported as abnormal in lab results that are actually not that significant. And, your doctor's job is to go through and figure out what is important and what to talk to you about. And as you live with any disease, you get a little more familiar with what the numbers are and what they mean, but don't overthink it. I guess that's what I'll say for today. Pass it on to the next presenter.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Butler. That was a wonderful presentation, excellent content on multiple myeloma, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Just a stellar presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Ruben Mesa. Dr. Mesa is President, Atrium Health, Levine Cancer Institute, Executive Director, Atrium Health, Wake Forest Baptist Comprehensive Cancer Center, Enterprise Senior Vice President, Atrium Health, Vice Dean for Cancer Programs, Wake Forest University School of Medicine, the Charles L. Spur MD Professor of Medicine, Wake Forest University School of Medicine. And Dr. Mess will be addressing updates from ASH on myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs, and key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mesa.
Dr. Messer, it's always a pleasure to be here and provide some updates regarding the myeloproliferative neoplasms at ASH 2024. So as a baseline, we speak of myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs, really as three diseases: essential thrombocythemia, polycythemia vera, in myelofibrosis. In essential thrombocythemia, we have two therapies that are primarily utilized with the goal of trying to prevent blood clots, bleeding, disease progression, and alleviate symptoms, with hydroxyurea being the cornerstone of therapy, anagrelide being used as a therapy, sometimes as a backup for the lowering of platelets, and now ongoing phase 3 studies internationally regarding the use of long-acting pegylated interferons to try to lower counts, improve symptoms, and delay disease progression. And those trials are accruing with ropegylated interferon alpha-2b. Additionally, there are ongoing studies with the agent bomedemstat with data on each of these at this year's ASH. These trials are ongoing, so no final data. And this LSD1 inhibitor is a pill trying to control platelets in those in which they have not been adequately controlled. Second is polycythemia vera. So the disease, like ET, risk of blood clots, bleeding, the potential for symptoms, and the potential for disease progression. The cornerstones of therapy also include hydroxyurea, or long-acting interferons as typically frontline therapy, was now the approved agent of ropegylated interferon alpha-2b or pegylated interferon alpha-2a. Both used, both have the potential of controlling counts, decreasing the genetic evidence of the disease, the allele burden, alleviating symptoms, and potentially decreasing the likelihood of disease progression. Additionally, there is the JAK inhibitor ruxolitinib, approved for about 10 years, helps to improve symptoms, need for phlebotomies, and may have an impact on disease progression. There was both mature data evolving with the trial from with rusfertide that's in a phase III trial that is a hepcidin mimetic to decrease the need for phlebotomies. No final data yet at this year's ASH, but that's anticipated soon. There's an agent earlier in development that was discussed at this year's ASH that's a new technology using a silencing RNA to try to decrease the JAK2 signal. This agent, divesiran, early data was presented that is interesting, but still early on, but there are new therapies in development. Now, the majority of new therapies are being developed for myelofibrosis because this has been the most severe of the MPNs and cause symptoms, enlargement of the spleen, low blood counts, and the potential for progression to acute leukemia or to be life-threatening. We now have four approved therapies: ruxolitinib, fedratinib, pacritinib, and momelotinib. They all reduce the size of the spleen. They all improve symptoms. In responders, they likely all have some benefit in terms of helping individuals live longer. Pacritinib has a particular niche for individuals with lower platelets. Momelotinib, the most recent of them approved, helping to improve anemia. There was data at this year's ASH showing fedratinib long-term safety, as well as its impact on other more uncommon MPNs, such as mixed MPN, MDS overlap syndromes, or chronic neutrophilic leukemia. Additionally, there was a new JAK inhibitor discussed from China that's early in testing, but the results seemed impressive, potentially more active than the other JAK inhibitors from the past. However, it's early in its testing and will require further validation. There's a tremendous amount of interest in the combination studies of a JAK inhibitor plus a second agent. Updated data from the MANIFEST study using the BET inhibitor pelabresib was presented, showing very impressive results of decreases in the size of the spleen in terms of at least equivalent improvement in symptoms compared to ruxolitinib, and benefit in other markers such as fibrosis and anemia. There was a lot of excitement regarding initial data from a phase III study with the agent naftamadlin that operates in a slightly different way in combination, showing both evidence in the biology of the disease using additional markers, as well as improvement in spleen and symptoms. There's a new agent called nuvisertib, or TP-3654, showing good activity, particularly in the realm of symptoms, and that will be heading toward a phase III trial. Additional important information presented at ASH was that regarding genetic changes with a gene called P53, or TP53, showing very concerning risk for individuals that have this change, particularly with more advanced disease, and further study is needed, but that's a particular red flag if physicians see that present. New things in development discussed at ASH include targeted approaches for calreticulin, with two ongoing studies, one a monoclonal antibody and the second a bispecific, and CAR T therapy targeted against CALR for patients with myelofibrosis, or ET. Additionally, a lot of buzz around the JAK2 V617F specific inhibitors from Ajax and from Incyte. Finally, Dr. Messer asked that I just touch base regarding symptoms and quality of life. These diseases are chronic diseases, and how you feel really matters. not on its own, not independent of everything else. When I sit with a patient with an MPN, we're trying to assess how are you really affected overall, how you feel, symptoms related to the disease, any side effects from the treatment. Are you having difficulties affording the treatment? Is it really having great financial strain on you? Is there a risk of disease progression? Are your blood counts low and they put you at risk? Do we fear you have risk of disease progression? All of these things really factor in together. Do strongly feel that when you have a chronic disease, understanding your symptoms, measuring them, seeing the impact of therapy is an important discussion point between you and your physicians to balance against everything else you're trying to achieve. In the past, when we had diseases like blood diseases or cancers, people would have bad side effects, but for a limited amount of time in regard to treatment. With chronic diseases, we aim for the disease to be as invisible in your life as possible. And with that, let me hand it back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Messner. That was a superb presentation, incredible information, very comprehensive, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Regina to go ahead and bring on the Q&A.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only, and you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Dr. Morrow. Are there trials using CRISPR for blood cancer?
Sure. So CRISPR technology, which is also called gene editing, very provocative and exciting technology. I think we've seen it more used in inherited or lifelong blood diseases where there's an inborn error. I think with a bit more progress and the use in leukemias, I know it's very tempting. For example, I get asked all the time, if there's a gene that's causing a blood cancer, can't you just edit it out? I think a lot of leukemias are much more complicated. They involve multiple steps, and a single gene might, if it could be removed with a CRISPR technology, wouldn't be necessarily a curative approach. So suffice it to say that there are definitely trials using CRISPR in blood cancers or blood disorders, and I think the future is pretty bright that CRISPR could be a technique in the laboratory for sure, and maybe even in the clinic, to either be a partial adjunctive tool or maybe even a primary treatment. I don't think we're there yet, though.
Thank you. And for Dr. Ghosh, what would you use to treat relapsed Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma, the standard treatment now is based on what someone received in frontline. So, you know, if somebody received, you know, ABVD-based type of regimen in frontline, you know, then, you know, you would use something like a brentuximab-based salvage regimen in second line, or you could use like a PD-1 inhibitor based salvage regimen like Pembro GVD or nivolumab in combination with chemotherapy like Nivo-ICE, and a brentuximab-based regimen could be either brentuximab alone or brentuximab in combination with ICE chemotherapy or brentuximab bendamustine, but basically either a targeted CD30 ADC or a PD-1 inhibitor-based salvage to get you the best possible response, which means PET negative complete remission, metabolic complete remission, followed by an autologous transplant. That being said, there's work going on in the research field to, again, just like mantle cell lymphoma in frontline, now in second line in Hodgkin lymphoma, whether does everybody who is fit and can get a transplant, should they all receive a transplant, or can some patients not get a transplant in second line. The cure rate with transplant, especially if somebody gets a complete remission in second line, is very high. So, you know, we have to be very careful as we design these studies that we don't lower that cure rate. But that's sort of the, standard treatment for Hodgkin lymphoma refractory or relapsed after frontline therapy.
Thank you so much. And for Dr. Butler, is there progress in soldiering multiple myeloma and deciding to go ahead with treatment versus delaying treatment?
There is. That was actually one of the studies that was talked about at ASH that I didn't make time to mention. We've long had some data that certain smoldering myeloma patients, those that have at least two out of three high risk criteria, may benefit from starting treatment with lenalidomide. The trouble is that by definition, someone with smoldering myeloma doesn't have any symptoms, may not develop the full-blown disease, and so for some of those patients, the treatment is unnecessary, and there can be side effects, and so it's been a hard decision. And Revlimid is a great drug, but there's a couple of dark sides to it that give us pause to give it to someone who may not need it. So the new study is looking at daratumumab or Darzalex, which has become one of our workhorse drugs for this disease, using that as a maintenance treatment for, again, selected patients with smoldering myeloma. The study was positive. It showed that we can prevent, we can significantly lower the risk of turning into myeloma by starting this treatment earlier, and it's still an easier treat to be on Darzalex than it is to be on a multi-drug combination. I still think it's going to take a long time for the consensus to emerge about should we do this for everyone or certain people or how to discuss it, because there are pros and cons. If we use Darzalex earlier, we've already used it, and if we needed it later, it may not work as well. So you can argue it either way, but yes, there's a lot of interest in that area, and there is new data, and I think treating smoldering myeloma is easier now than it was a few weeks ago before we had that data, because now we have two options instead of one.
Thank you so much. And for Dr. Mesa, updates on myelofibrosis in patients who can't tolerate JAK inhibitors.
So in terms of this year's ASH, there are several of those agents being tested in that setting. One, naftamatlin on its own for people that can't tolerate a JAK inhibitor, as well as nuvisertib. For those that have only just not been able to tolerate ruxolitinib, one can consider momelotinib or pacritinib if the reason for not tolerating was related to low blood counts, or if it was for another reason, let's say an allergic reaction, we might consider fedratinib.
Thank you so much. And to provide a takeaway, if we could start with Dr. Morrow, just a quick takeaway for each of you, and then we'll conclude the program.
Thanks, Carolyn. So, I think the takeaway from maybe all of these presentations, and particularly for me in leukemia, is that we never seem to miss a beat, and we continue with research into new areas, discovering new targets, better ways to treat our patients. And I would leave as a pearl for patients, family members, loved ones to have an open line of communication with your doctors and seek clinical trials, because some of them are very exciting.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Ghosh?
I echo Dr. Morrow's sentiments, and I'll say that in lymphoma, the field is moving more towards more targeted agents, bispecific antibodies, and and the CAR T-cell therapy, as well as other targeted agents such as BTK inhibitors, and sort of really moving them up front, moving them earlier in lines of therapy, and chemo is slowly taking the back seat.
Thank you so much. Dr. Mehta.
So I would leave individuals really with a strong sense of hope. In the myeloproliferative neoplasms, at the beginning of my career, we had no FDA-approved therapies for any of these conditions, and I listed conservatively about 20 different therapies that now are either approved or well advanced in their testing. So I'd be very hopeful. We're making great progress. and really hoping to further breakthroughs in 2025.
And Dr. Butler, did you want to give a takeaway as well?
Yeah, I think that there are many, many people working to move us closer to a day when we can cure multiple myeloma. We haven't reached that point yet, and it's a long and slow process to get there. But progress is being made in that direction. In the meantime, the way you can beat a disease like this is by living well with it, and I think that. It just as important as living longer, and we've made incredible strides there, is helping people have a better quality of life, more tolerable treatments, and able to kind of shift their focus away from their disease, which is may always be a part of your life, but we want it to be as small a part as possible.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I'm going to just thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank all of our participants for asking such great questions. I also want to recognize that there were many more questions than we could take, but I want to give you a couple of thoughts about that. For those of you who got to ask a question, and for those of you who have a question in queue yet to ask, please take your question back to Treating Healthcare team. They, of course, know you the best, and they actually will be able to provide you they know everything about you. They have all your records in front of them, and they will be able to answer your questions. One thing I want to remind you that we are entering into a period of time of the holidays, and so during the day it is often possible to reach your team, but sometimes on evenings, weekends, and holidays, you need to find out from your healthcare team who's on call, so that who's available to answer your questions if you have questions, and they usually come up on weekends, holidays, and evenings. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.